Now, recently, there has been much talk of change. Yes, change, the great energy that brings construction and destruction, enjoyment and suffering, conflict or indulgence. To exist is to understand that all must change. And in that...
What's that, Lord and Master Zinch? Yes, I know. I'm telling them right now.
So it is change that we discuss today. And to be absolutely clear, as YouTubers are a fine, upstanding, altogether honourable breed, they certainly never would be the ones to chase easy metrics, and to do so would be an underhanded strategy worthy of the changer of the ways. An entity I wish to note that I have absolutely no affiliation with whatsoever, and you should certainly not consider anything I say as being biased, tainted, contingent, or part of any element within a far grander master plan to incept and sow seeds of discord and chaos that could, say, dry out the sweatiest and thirstiest of Slaaneshi followers. Change, it is ever present, and an undeniable reality, for much that once was, is lost. Joking aside, today's discussion is largely my own speculation, just to get that out of the way, but it's also not entirely speculative, as it's also informed by the fact that there are continued signs of a carefully necessary dilution of Slaanesh through ever more common uses of generic phrasing like pleasures beyond comprehension, perversity, but then just skipping any detail whatsoever. This is not entirely new when it comes to material which covers Slaanesh. There's a lot of generalized explorations talking about excess, twisted means, perversity, blah blah blah, but it never really dives into things, and that doesn't necessarily mean things have to be explicit, it just means that we don't get to the kind of core fundamental emotional explorations. In the very recent Lord of Excess, for example, minimal spoilers incoming, whilst it's generally an enjoyable Slaaneshi jaunt which sees an Imperial planet score a spectacular own goal by welcoming the forces of chaos openly through its doors, there was a considerable focus upon the warriors of Slaanesh having higher functioning goals, a significant amount of effort placed on the internal thoughts of the Third Legion, and how even their desires that we might consider to be pretty ordinary are raised to be higher desires, like the lust for battle to come, but then the enjoyment and the indulgence of battle, and a marine unable to decide which one they preferred more, which is pretty tame stuff to really be thinking about. And I find this sort of exploration of the mentality of an Astartes dedicated to a supposed god of excess to be, quite honestly for me, dull and not very representative, with only some of the more extreme worshippers, such as the Noise Marines, and those who have become twisted beyond recognition as really what we might imagine as those dedicated to the Prince of Pleasure. But this is one of the confusing things about Chaos, but specifically about Slaanesh, is that it can depend entirely on who you are looking at and what angle you are coming from, because obviously there are those who wish to place themselves wholly within the arms of one of the gods, worship and try and drive more toward them, but then there are many of the traitor space marines, like obviously the Black Legion, the Word Bearers, the Night Lords, the Iron Warriors, who see chaos as something that they should use rather than something they should give themselves over to. And this is what is interesting about chaos, is there are many different aspects and ways to approach it and understand it, and ways to see humans engage with it and become more twisted and distorted or not, and just a lot of psychology there as well. Unfortunately, the psychology aspect is often not what we get so much, it tends to be space marine battles. But with Slaanesh, it also swings in the other direction when it comes to the community, because I would say now more than ever, the viewpoints that you tend to see Slaanesh represented as are more distilled, with 90% of them being anytime we reference Slaanesh, it's anime tentacles, nerve-shredding torture, unending human sensory suffering. Yet most often when it comes to the actual lore, these baser pleasures are of course all far beneath those who are the main character focus for Slaanesh lore. We don't want to dirty ourselves with any of that base pleasure nonsense. So instead of seeing and describing the physical effects, the trials, the mental trials that those who might fall into Slaanesh go through, now we should just have a nice talk and a talk, and then maybe talk some more about each character's history, their goals, their enemies, their internal satisfactions for minor pleasures, and of course how they wish to serve Slaanesh, their interactions with demons, possessions, higher functioning of course. Basically, anything but depict actual horror or the acts and scenarios placed upon those who fall into Slaanesh's waiting more and be dragged through a sensory experience beyond comprehension. Of course, if there is any horror to be had, it has to be very brutal and visceral, not refined and certainly not suggestive. Or to put it another way, we're not seeing a Slaanesh version of Dead Sky Black Sun set on a Sororitas world anytime soon. And it might be overdramatic to say that you are witnessing the death of Slaanesh in real time, but the question is, what form will that take, and why is it Yvraine fighting it out with Slaanesh? Slaanesh is one of the more interesting of the Chaos Gods, second only perhaps to Tzeentch in my opinion, because unlike Khorne and Nurgle, that are in many ways more straightforward, Slaanesh is the god of excess. It is the god of experience and beyond. And that's like fine, but also what does that really mean? How do you translate that to actual material? And that is really part of the problem, because the confusion begins with the fact that Slaanesh is referred to as a god of pleasure. Literally, it's the Prince of Pleasure, just one of the many names that it goes by. But this is something that often causes a fundamental misunderstanding. It seems straightforward enough. Slaanesh is the god of sexy times, giant anime boobs, and that's basically it. Except it's not, and this is one of the most annoying things about how Slaanesh is interpreted. At the same time, of course, it very much is part of what Slaanesh is, it's just that it's something that is barely spoken about in the lore, and you could probably make conclusions as to why. But part of the problem with Slaanesh is the fact that so much of what it is ends up being omitted, and it doesn't really dive down into the meat of things. Whereas with something like Nurgle and Khorne, it's much easier to do that because you can represent it in battle. A lot of this I attribute also to the meme lore of 40k, the idea of the Eldar murdering and sexing Slaanesh into existence, which to be clear is not entirely wrong, but this is only one aspect of it. And some of this lies also with the fact that this period of the lore is understandably, but also unforgivably, not documented. Meaning we have little, if any, real descriptions of the Eldar Fall, and any that do exist are extremely generic and late in the day. I often really wish we could have a look at the earliest beginnings of the Eldar Fall. A Farseer forced to convene psychically or recall a dream, a past experience, as we've seen happen in novels like Wild Rider, visions of past times. This could easily be done within the scope of 40k writing, and I'm honestly desperate to hear about the corrupting collapse that slowly began the exponential decay of one of the greatest civilizations ever seen in the galaxy. But I think that one of the reasons people consider Slaanesh as tentacle sexy time is due to the Dark Eldar themselves, because they are usually seen as the nightmarish, torturing ones, and Slaanesh is seen as the nightmarish, sexy one. Yes, but also no. Slaanesh is primarily a deity who consists of the purest concept possible of excess and sensory experiences of any kind, mainly though excess. It's the concept of, it's the end point of someone who is literally unable to control themselves, like an addict, somebody who places themselves above all else, and they don't have the ability to exhibit or reason with empathy toward others. Or if they do, it's only at an internal level because they have become so completely immersed into debasing themselves, so dependent that they're indulging in the suffering of others. They've become so completely desensitized that they can only be satisfied by more and more extreme experiences, which can obviously apply to any base instinct, but it can also rise far above this. In a deeper sense, it's the idea that Slaanesh is one of the most simple and seemingly harmless gods of chaos in terms of how you might fall into worshipping it. It's very easy to become a worshipper of Slaanesh. In the beginning it might seem very harmless, not unlike Tzeentch also. It begins at a very small scale, with humans indulging pleasures, often base pleasures, eating, sex, etc. Anything which is basically flooding you with endorphins. This could also be combat or I guess even just achievement. But over time the concept of just what constitutes pleasure becomes a twisted point of view. Because although the core term that defines the experience of Slaanesh is pleasure, what this means to any one person is a broad scale of experience. Because obviously for some people, pleasure could mean cruelty. One might, for example, experience astonishing pleasure from art, or you might enjoy a rare delicacy from some world that was exorbitantly expensive, destructive even, to produce. In eating that food, you would be washed over with thoughts that were beyond the physical taste and smell of what you consumed, but also in the knowledge, the understanding of the experience you were having. As you bite into it, you're pleasured by the suffering of others that brought this to you. And in this moment, you savour all that came before to bring you this moment, this item, here and now. And maybe in eating it, some of it spills out, dribbles down your neck. Maybe you do not even eat all of it and discard some of the remains. To be so wasteful of such a precious thing, that is truly decadent excess. I think this, for me, is a perfect example of how Slaanesh does not have to be all about sexy time. It's about sensual pleasures that can blend and blur the lines between pleasure and suffering, its debasement, but not always of the physical pleasures. There is something far darker in that, and ultimately something that becomes more and more self-destructive over time. And this is in fact one of the reasons I think Slaanesh is the most problematic of Chaos Gods for Games Workshop to represent. Because almost inevitably, when you start following along that line of self-destructive behaviour, it leads to fairly disturbing, problematic acts that they really can't or don't want to get into. Abusive actions towards others, torturous engagements, cruelty, and sadism. And it's why whenever they speak to demons of Slaanesh, cults of Slaanesh, activities occurring, it's kind of out of view. They use all the key words, but it's kind of blurry. And it's why I also think things like noise marines exist, because they are an acceptable representation of the extreme excesses of Slaanesh without having to deal with the problematic aspects. Noise marines are Chaos Astartes, if you didn't know, of the Third Legion, the Emperor's Children, and they fell into the worship of Slaanesh through delivering extreme forms of sound, music, harmony, whatever you choose to define it. I'm not going to retell the entire story of how the Emperor's Children found noise marines through the choir thing and all that stuff. That's a different story. To ordinary humans witnessing a noise marine, they are just horrific things. They produce nothing approaching harmony or even music. And no matter how metal or brightly people paint the miniature of that classic noise marine on his guitar rocking out, it's just another example of the extreme disconnect between miniatures and lore. Because in the lore, that's just not how noise marines are. They're not bright and cool. They are disgusting. I think often more comparable to the followers of Nurgle than Slaanesh, quite honestly. An example, as was described recently, a human encounters a noise marine, they're horrified and shocked by just what they are. They mistakenly presume their face is quite literally melted due to combat, and they've suffered some catastrophic injury. But beyond their physical presence, just even a noise marine's breathing hum and static hiss that emits from them is insufferably antagonizing for mortals around them. But the point is, noise marines are something that is quite tame in the scale of how we could choose to engage with the perspectives of Slaanesh. This is not untrue of other notable figures such as Lucius and Fabius Bile as well, even Fulgrim, quite honestly, because they are all these high champions of Slaanesh. They operate at a level that is very acceptable in their descriptions of what they seek to achieve, and rarely do we descend into the full, unvarnished, raw perversity and horror that is Slaanesh. So returning to the wider thought of how Slaanesh is represented, I've often noted one of the most obvious crossovers when it comes to 40k is the horrors seen in legendary author Clive Barker's creation, the Cenobites from Hellraiser, who follow their own god, Leviathan. This title of Cenobites for the troop in fact defines them, because a Cenobite relates to a member of a religious group living together in a monastic community. Now, it's an admittedly adjacent sideways look at how they are presented, but it's fairly applicable. They're wholly consumed in the worship of their ambiguous god Leviathan, which only appears to use a geometric form for itself. It never speaks and appears to govern a realm where experience and even the laws of reality have no limit. And in terms of Leviathan, I'm always reminded of the description Fabius Bile gives when he witnesses what may have been the gods of chaos in Clone Lord. He looked up and something looked down. It was not a face, for a face was a thing of limits and angles, and what he saw had neither. It stretched as far as his eyes could see, as if it were one with the whole of the sky and the firmament above. It studied him from an impossible distance, and he felt the sharp edge of its gaze cut through him layer by layer. There was pain in that gaze, and pleasure as well, agony and ecstasy, inextricable and inseparable. Now that's very applicable, But it's also a perfect example of what I'm talking about when it comes to Slaanesh, in that the words are very pertinent, they're very correct, but they're also quite vague. Agony and ecstasy, and it's like, okay, but you could describe more there. He could have visions of things. We could use language to describe how it's penetrating his soul, cutting into his being. In the more recent Hellraiser reboot, which I actually thought was pretty good, when one of our characters looks up to see Leviathan, it's not just agony and ecstasy. It twists and distorts his body, it twists and distorts his soul, his form, and the indescribable layers of pain therein. And this is very much Leviathan in terms of its interaction with humans. It appears to focus on the extreme body modification and sensory experience. But I've always thought that this may not in fact be the singular focus for Leviathan, because we know so little of what it is or what it governs and oversees. It may simply be that this is how it interprets and is able to process the human experience. Which to me is interesting, because that is not entirely unlike the experiences one might expect within the warp. It's comparable to how the warp and the beings who exist within that realm interact and relate with humanity. This realm is a reflection. When Fabius Bile is looking up and seeing the gods there, it is the mirror of our reality, but seen in the most abhorrent and darkest corners of mortal experience. Most importantly, it reflects what we are through our dreams, unconscious and conscious lives, and so we define it as much as it defines us. Now, I said earlier about the fact that people tend to think of the Jukari also as the pain ones, and Slaanesh as the sexy pain ones. I think, honestly, this only stems from the need in the tabletop world of 40k to create some clear factional separations. I think in actuality, Slaanesh would contain just as much nightmare-fueled suffering as the Jukari, the Night Lords, and some of the horrors unleashed by Nurgle, which literally tear apart mortal beings and destroy them wholly in every conceivable way. Slaanesh should be all of these things and more. It won't shock you to know that as somebody who's consumed by storytelling and narrative, that I've read a great deal from classics to horror, sci-fi, and so on and so on. I'm sure you have as well. Along with, of course, seeking out obscure films, often a lot of world films, pretty extreme horror from time to time. My dad, for example, had a massive stack of horror books that I read through as a kid, and now I reflect that this might not have been the best thing to do at the time, but it shaped my appreciation for narrative and human experience. In a more contemporary sense, there are many movies that I've often watched and then wished that I had not, because there's some absolutely nightmarish horror movies out there. But I do always consider this important for gathering perspective. But again, it's not always the most base perversity that is in fact the most upsetting. One of the scenes, for example, that I find significantly harrowing for all time is in the film Never Let Me Go. Now, heavy spoilers, skip ahead 60 seconds or so if you don't want this, but Never Let Me Go is, it's truly a harrowing dystopian movie based on the Ishiguro novel of the same name. The concept within the story is about human lifespan being extended through the use of clones, who are raised without the knowledge of what they are, and who are in later life harvested for their organs for wealthy people to extend their life. This is seen as morally acceptable because as clones they are seen as less than human or without having a soul. So it's horrific enough already. But it comes to an absolutely unbearable moment when two main characters who believed that if they could prove themselves as feeling true love, they would be spared this horrifying fate. But they discover that this is in fact a nightmarish lie. The earth-breaking reality of this realization is so painful, as is illustrated in this scene. Now, I don't know about you, but to me, this is about 100 times more painful and uncomfortable than all the most gory horror films together. Truth be told, I'm not even a big horror fan, or even have a particularly strong stomach for that matter. I'm very much not one of those people who is just immune to gore, except it's easily forgettable and dismissible as just fake movie effects. On the other hand, I remember when Squid Game came out and people were talking about how unbearably horrifying it was, and I was bracing myself, and then I was like, oh, it's just fine. Because for me, I find the psychological effect of horror movies to be the more difficult thing to handle. It's the thought of what would the real world consequences be. If you're placing yourself immersively and emotionally within the position of a character, how would that affect you? How would you deal with this? It's this destruction of the human spirit that is the most horrifying of all, the death of hope, like you would see in something like 1984. the annihilation of everything we could understand to be true, the realization of our place and our meaningless in the grand scale of things. Now that to me is a true illustration of what Slaanesh is. It is nightmarish. It is pleasure, but it is also the most extreme scale of suffering. It is human experience extended far above the base level. And I'll get into that more in the next chapter. But when it comes to Slaanesh, our perspectives of them tend to come from Astartes, the Emperor's children. And most often that means a high level of understanding and artistry. Because the Emperor's children are, as we see among all the traitors, all manner of different war bands. Rarely is a traitor legion fully united as it was during the Crusade and the Heresy, which is just as well for the Imperium. But moreover, most of the Astartes are very individual in their goals, much more so than the Loyalist Chapter Astartes, who are just usually following their orders and their instructions, whereas traitor marines are kind of just off out there doing whatever they want. Because Chaos Marines tend to have more nuanced personal goals. They're also just open to taking an opportunity to indulge in whatever comes their way. So all of the ways in which those of the Emperor's children choose to worship with Slaanesh fall into usually the higher category. So the ways in which those of the Emperor's children choose to worship Slaanesh generally fall into the higher category, for they were, even before the Heresy, amazing artisans, masters of blade, their own form of artistry. Some of their number are astonishingly beautiful to look upon, seeking absolute perfection in all regards, whereas others are twisted forms who have fallen toward the more distorted interpretations of pleasure. The major point for me, and something that I do find irritating a little, is that Astartes are not the bulk of Slaanesh worshippers. They are not the demon forms of Slaanesh. They're not subject to what humans would experience upon, say, a demon world consumed by the warp and home to the followers of Slaanesh. The Astartes are above this, and in some ways they can't even experience it in that way. And this is why I titled this section the Slaaneshi POV, because how we see Slaanesh is highly dictated by the view we are seeing it from, the view we are given, perhaps more so than any other Chaos God. Slaanesh is not a deity of the warriors, which is why it's quite a distortion that Slaanesh is most often demonstrated to us through Astartes, who admittedly on the one hand can experience through the nature of their physical form more than humans, but on the other hand there are many things which they absolutely cannot experience. And Slaanesh is the god of pleasure, it's the god of excess, of artists, of sensualists, the debased extremes of the human condition, and the permutations for how it can be interpreted are almost infinite. Unsurprisingly, the worship of Slaanesh will be found most often deep within hive cities and those of affluent status. And whilst that's happening, the Emperor's children, like all Astartes, seek power to enable their own goals, their own personal vendettas, or whatever it is they think they're supposed to be doing. So really, they are more interested in creating new worshippers for Slaanesh to gather its attention, to capture and be rewarded with some of its power. That's really what they're doing. For a human, it's both the same and very, very different. Because those who worship Slaanesh in its own name do so to seek, yes, power. And to achieve power, remember, you need the attention of the gods and the warp. Achieving this is extraordinarily difficult, because the Chaos Gods already pay staggeringly minimal attention to the mortal materium. Any attention they do give tends to be directed towards their champions like Fabius Bile, Fulgrim, and so on. And that's because their schemes, their actions are so impactful and carry such a gravity that it can impact billions, even trillions, of individuals. And this often means grand plans or a very perverse, nuanced scheme. And it's again that idea of 1,000 Astartes killing 1,000 Astartes toward the end of the Heresy is in fact pretty incomparable to one Astartes in the early Heresy shooting another across the table, as they were entirely unwitting such an action were even possible. See Betrayal at Kalth. Chaos and the Warp react only to the most twisted actions, and the very idea that an Astartes would kill their brothers in cold blood at the opening of the Heresy was so incomprehensible, so impossible to ever have believed, that it represented one of the most morally perverse, sinful acts. Now, it's not to say that you couldn't achieve the same results by just flaying a ton of innocence, but it's going to have to be a lot of innocence, as seen in Voidstalker and the Nightlords, which I actually think is worth referencing, but there is a quite considerable number of flayings described in many Nightlord novels. But for example, He watched them drag men, women and children by the hair out into the street to be skinned and carried away by servitors or crucified on the side of buildings to mark that the closest shelter had been raided and cleaned out of all life. He saw the bodies hauled into the skinning pits, great mounds of flayed corpses stacked higher and higher, monuments of raw flesh in honour of nothing more than suffering and pain. Or how about this one? She walked among the chained bodies, between the slabs on which they lay, weaving through the Medicaid servitors monotasked with keeping the carcasses alive just a little longer. The husks laid out on each table scarcely resembled humans in any real sense. One was a mess of musculature and stripped veins, twitching its final moments away on the surgery table. The flayed ones were little better, neither were those deprived of their tongues, lips, hands, and noses. Ruination was complete on each and every one of them. Desecration had never seen such variety. She was walking through a living monument to fear and pain. This was the Legion's imagination given form. Octavia looked back at Talos, glad he still wore his helm. If she'd seen any pride in his naked eyes in that moment, she would have never been able to tolerate his presence again. The screaming gallery, she said, above the muffled moans and beep of pulse trackers. Was it like this? The Night Lord nodded. Very much so. Now do it, he said again. Octavia took a stale breath, moved to the closest table, and removed her bandana. I will end it for you, she whispered to the organic wreckage that had once been a man. It turned its eyes towards her with the last of its strength, lifted its wet gaze to the navigator's third eye, and looked into absolute oblivion. The point to make here is that these are pretty horrific, but they're still reasonably restrained descriptions of the general activities of the Night Lords, who are still Astartes and not even twisted demon forms. I cannot recall anything even approaching such descriptions, which are pretty, like I say, commonplace for the Night Lords, but given a Slaanesh perspective. And comparably, to achieve the attentions of Slaanesh, you're going to have quite a lot of, let's say, human gatherings to achieve the level of attention you need from Slaanesh. But it could also be one of the easier gods to gain attention from, because the human mind is infinitely twisted, and so to concoct a truly diabolical plan of immoral suffering and pleasure is more than within the realm of possibility for someone who is tempted by dark desires, whereas the Night Lords have to just keep skinning people over and over again. This though leads me on to my next point, which is that for myself, Slaanesh as a god and as a thought exercise has really not been explored in an interesting or meaningful way so far. Again, I reference the Warhammer Crime series, which I cannot recommend enough. These deal with life at the human scale, not the Astartes scale, and that's really what I'm talking about here. It's about dealing with life deep down in the filth, the decay of human experience and hive worlds, which is where the real boundaries of experience and suffering, exploitation, greed, sadistic goals and so on lie. In many respects, Astartes don't care if they live or die because they're sort of built for war. They know they're going to die in war. They know they're going to die in these kind of conflicts. Whereas a human perspective down on a hive world, they care so greatly about their life, people that are close to them, and in terms of Slaanesh, that is far more lucrative to be able to exploit. It's undoubtedly, of course, a very difficult, a very thorny thing to tackle, but also to not do so would be, in my personal opinion, a significantly wasted opportunity. Slaanesh is true horror. It is the most horrific of the Chaos Gods because of what it deals with. It's the most soul-destroying and nightmarish aspect of them all, human desire, which is a pretty big tent to be sure, but within it is attached a key concept of our desires and what we are willing to do to achieve them. In ordinary life, this would be simple. Work hard, try your best, etc. Then in terms of ordinary life, on the more extreme scale, there is protecting everything we hold dear, loved ones, our home. But there's also the flip side, as anybody who has fallen into the darkest pits of the human soul would see. And that is, what we may be willing to do to achieve such things is almost anything. But the reason I say this is a wasted opportunity of exploration is that often, in what is classed as Slaanesh material for 40k, it explores, as I already covered, the goals of Marines, Astartes, within the Emperor's Children. Figures like Fabius and Lucius, there might be some demons present here or there who are getting in the mix, but on a sliding scale of human perversity and horror, I would argue most of the time it's pretty mid. So to give one of the few examples that was at least starting to lean in a direction as to what we might imagine as Slaanesh, or one of the better illustrations as to what I think of as Slaanesh, was in the novel Demon World, which is a slightly older story as well, and I'll quote a shortened excerpt. Pleasure cults in pack animal mobs roamed as the buildings grew taller and broader, sought out new sensations in streets that narrowed and crushed as the buildings expanded and contracted like huge stone organs. Temples to Slaanesh were suspended on ropes of human hair above bottomless pits, silken pavilions protected by huge sweeping blades of gold and silver, armatures and demon-bound engines studded with diamonds. The city itself didn't have a name, and was usually referred to as the city, or the capital, or not mentioned at all, for it was simply the hinterland of Charybdis Keep. The mines beneath the city supplied its materials, and the city itself a mine for slave courtesans and the substances that could only be rendered down from the living. Her skin was decorated, not with anything so crude as tattoos, but with elegant spirals so faintly etched that they were only visible to someone who concentrated for many minutes on the play of light against Lady Charybdis's body. Very few people, however, would dare to stare at Torin Vendis's ruler in such a way. The thought pleased her. The clouded crystal swam, and images emerged. Lady Charybdis willed them into distinct columns and rows, each one a different facet of the planet that she considered to belong to her. It existed for the pleasures of Slaanesh, the god to whom she offered all her praises. But the rocks and the seas and the flesh and blood of its inhabitants, those were hers to mould like clay into whatever form she saw fit. It was this act, and the place of her imagination in it, that formed her worship. A writhing slab of flesh throbbed in one of the city's main buildings, bathed in the light of their lust. Lady Charybdis felt a faint nostalgia for the days when she had been young and naive, and had thrown herself with abandon into the orgiastic rites of Slaanesh. She had suffered the degradations, the triumphs of those times, and emerged as a true emissary of the Prince of Pleasure, given to the pure pleasures refined from the bodies and souls of her subjects. Though she herself was an aesthetate, there were still untold millions of her underlings who worshipped Slaanesh in only as sophisticated a manner as their unenlightened minds could comprehend, hence the pulsing knot of tangled limbs. Lady Charybdis watched for a few moments as the slaves hacked away at the huge slope of rock, others sorting through the spoils that flowed down the rock face. They picked out finger bones, scraps of metal, the occasional jewelled armband or half-recognisable helmet. Many would call it a waste, thought Lady Charybdis, but she knew it was worth it. The constant refinement of sensation was her own form of Slaaneshi worship, and if the unwanted and defeated could not be put to work honouring her god, then what good were they at all? She reached out with her senses, and the scent of despair filled her, thick and purple, hot inside her head. It was the first she had discovered back when it seemed the galaxy itself was young, and she had never tired of it. They knew they would die, one way or another. And it was not just fear, but an utter lack of hope. The smell of abandonment and tragedy. A million, million broken spirits bleeding out into the air and into the sense centres of Lady Charybdis's soul. Now, it's older lore, but this is really one of the better representations of what Slaanesh is, and it's why I would love to see something comparable explored through the Warhammer Crime series, where we can just omit the Astartes and focus down on the human experience, with far greater emphasis on concepts of what it means to live, to exist, what it means to die, the waste, the extravagance, the indulgence, all of the concepts of sensation and excess, everything that is Slaanesh, because it's just not able to be explored deeply enough when the Astartes are the primary vehicle. Because, I know this might sound stupid, but Astartes are not human in the sense of how they would relate the most to Slaanesh. How can you plunge the depths of human experience when the core characters of your narrative do not relate in that way? It doesn't matter for stories about Khorne, Nurgle and Tzeentch, but it does matter for Slaanesh. Even the Eldar are admittedly more interesting as a subject for the exploration of Slaanesh than Astartes. For me, personally, anyway. It's in fact a shame that the Tau are so inconsequential for Chaos as well, because that would be an entirely new area to explore into. So Slaanesh, yes, is the Prince of Pleasure, but there's also the horror aspect, as in the mental and physical suffering angle for Slaanesh. And I think the kind of concepts that you could look to explore would be those seen in, for example, Saw. Now, bear with me, as I know on the face of it, you might think, Lutin, that's a stupid or very lowbrow example. Yes, it's not a particularly nuanced concept of a movie, but it is more representative of the questions that arise within the worship or the subjugation of those at the whim and desire of Slaanesh. And that's what we're thinking about here, i.e., what would you do to survive? Are there limits to that? How creatively can we explore that? And these concepts of what are you willing to do, or how does your conscious self become distorted over time, these are the things that we can imagine being employed by the twisted perversions of high noble members of a hive city, then dragging lower level humans up to participate for their morally bankrupt entertainment. Or for example, the Hostel series of movies. In Hostel 3, for example, a trash film where the gore is given the most thin veneer of narrative. But nonetheless, it's quite applicable to the 40k setting. Imagine again some high-born members of a hive city bringing unwilling victims from the lower levels. Maybe it's a cult and there's slight possessions and even demonettes or so on in the rooms around. Maybe they're bought from some guilders or slavers in the lower hive. They're raised up to the spire for the entertainment of the nobility, who will gamble and bet as they watch the victims undergoing truly nightmarish acts. Within Hostel, these are usually obviously also non-consensual. One dude has his face cut off, a woman is smothered in roaches, they eat her alive from the inside out, so on and so on and so on. Now these are just a couple of small examples, you could go on and on. There are so many examples, so many modern conversations that could be equally applicable from works of Shakespeare through to contemporary movies like Shame. Listing every possible literary and film reference that could encompass Slaanesh is very obviously not the purpose of today, although I will mention a couple later. But my simple point is that within the initial steps on the path to Slaanesh, they're very, very easy. They may seem very harmless. But the point is that as you begin to descend into the downward spiral toward open acceptance of Slaanesh, you eventually reach a point at where the actions of your own self are no longer enough. Because to gain power, to gain influence with Slaanesh, it is not just about you yourself, it is about spreading that and increasing that. Because once you become aligned with Slaanesh also, it's accepted that to bear the mark of Slaanesh will heighten your senses. But the dark twist is that all your sensations are heightened and more pleasurable. The unbearable cost of this is that you can never be satisfied with the same sensations, even a second or a third time. The repetition of the same sensory experiences dilutes the effect exponentially. Something within it is lost each time, and the desire, the dependence to achieve the initial high increases to where an individual's ordinary outlook will become completely twisted outside of human norms. Of course, to them, it will feel very ordinary. And this kind of thing is very typical with Chaos, the creatures, the space marines that are corrupted by the power of entropy in Nurgle, for example. They do not feel the sensory experience that humans would imagine upon encountering them. Death Guard Plague Marines, for example, do not suffer. For them, their existence is calm, rich, it's a pleasure to serve Nurgle. For those who would witness, what they are is to imagine an unbearably inescapable nightmare, as their bodies are bloated with skin which tears, distends, disintegrates with worms and maggots penetrating every organ and area of their body. That's the twisted reality of becoming one with Chaos. It distorts perception of reality as humans would see it, so that those who follow Chaos do not see anything wrong or unusual in what they are and what they are doing. So it is with Slaanesh. As with any Chaos God, if you're able to gain their attention and become instilled with a microscopic measure of their power, that individual would rise to become further symbolized by others within a cult to gain favor, desire, or drive inspiration among others. In this sense, it's also maybe the second easiest Chaos cult to slip under the radar of the Imperium, Tzeentch being the first. Because Slaanesh already blurs the lines between fairly standard human decadence. And that cycle of experience is not something that is explored or able to be explored greatly, because very often again we're limited to Slaanesh as viewed from Astartes, and Astartes tend to have Astartes goals. They're not really seeing that full descent into the annihilation of the self, the unendurable horror of those who have lost all humanity, and those who exist only to satiate the abstract perversions of those with the ability to indulge them. And this is something, again, illustrated to us most often within the stories of the Astartes, who, despite being some of the most elevated figures, presumably in the eyes of Slaanesh, and able to endure so much, they seem to enjoy fairly neutral pleasures. They seem most often to enjoy fairly neutral pleasures of anticipation, victory, satisfaction through their activities. Very occasionally we might get a glimpse of something base, disturbing, creative, but these are the exceptions. That subtle nuance, though, is why many humans fall into the arms of Slaanesh without even realizing they were slipping, until one day they wake up and think, wait, when did I start wearing this pain mask? It's a reason why, again, Inquisitors are so critical for the Imperium. Seeking out the roots of such pleasure cults and cells of suffering within a hive city are vital, because eventually, if they do not discover them, the entire hive of billions collapses under the weight of perversity, and holes in reality are then just being torn open, with mortal souls dragged into the horrors of the warp for experiences beyond imagination. Within that, there is also this idea of souls. What is a soul? I've tried to speak about this many times, but in truth it needs its own video, or in part 5 of Dark Origins. Don't ask me. Suffice to say though, my personal outlook is that in 40k souls vary in strength and survivability, which sounds strange, but as we can perceive it, it's often described how an Eldar soul or Drakari soul is more persistent than that of a human. Their souls hang around, they don't instantly dissipate or become devoured by the warp. This is why Drakari can often be returned to life, and why the Eldar used to be able to reincarnate, but now they use their soul stones to become part of their craft world, because before the existence of Slaanesh, their souls could return to the warp when they died, and then they would return to a new Eldar form as a reincarnation. This is why the Eldar were basically infinite and immortal during the war in heaven with the Necron. It's also why things like wraiths exist for the Eldar, and why I believe that during the war in heaven, the Eldar may have used their own souls to actually power and fuel weapons the likes of which have never been seen before or since. I also think it's possible that these creations contributed to warp disruption or other problems that persist to M41. Overall though, it's this idea of soul persistence and why the Eldar so greatly fear being captured by Slaanesh, because she who thirsts will keep their soul imprisoned and tortured for all eternity. Whereas human souls do not. Human souls, even Astartes souls, are weak and basically nothing. They have little resonance comparative to an Eldar soul, and so most simply will dissipate, and when I say dissipate, what is often termed as being devoured by the gods of the warp. But for a human, just who or how their soul is consumed is entirely beyond their control. All that matters is they're consumed by the warp. The strongest of humans though, in say psychers, or maybe those with very strong faith and will, they may persist further, but that may not be particularly favourable given what we know about the warp. Of course, there is that belief by the followers of the Imperial cult that any who worship the Emperor will be protected by him for all time in the warp. It's very possible that that is true, but it also equally could not be, given how much the Emperor generally seems to care for ordinary humans, which I find to be greatly comedic. That worshippers of the Emperor could be the most loyal servants for all their lives, and then when passing beyond into the warp, are then immediately tortured at the hands of nightmare creatures for eternity. The dark comedy of The Emperor Protects. Anyway, with all of this in mind, and in terms of how I envision the more interesting aspects of Slaanesh, I always think of it aligning perfectly with narratives that are what we might describe as more psychological. There are, of course, as I've said, an almost inexhaustible amount of examples that we could give. I'm sure you will have many of your own. Feel free to put them down in the comments. Because in human history, thoughts about experiencing and exploring what it means to be human, what is our reality, how do we place limits upon that, what do concepts like right, wrong, pleasure, suffering really mean to any one person? If we were ever going to really explore the understanding of what Slaanesh is, then we have to think about how it can twist and distort the human condition, and that has to occur through examples and narrative exploration. It needs to break apart and question what we have constructed for ourselves in terms of a guideline of how humans exist within the constraints, the limits, is dictated by society, our understanding of what morality is as a necessity for survival. There are so many narrative means by which this could be explored, and like I said, there are so many that already exist. Off the top of my head, a few examples were like Requiem for a Dream, with the obvious themes of addiction, excess, the novel Tarantula, My Gale, because of how it deals with concepts of consent, individuality, violence, control, emotional destruction. The anime Perfect Blue, it's quite a harrowing look into the psychological damage of obsession and idolization. I thought of Oldboy, which admittedly has a lot to do with revenge, but I think also suffering, desire, debasement. Ian M. Banks has a lot of good references that could be applicable. Firstly, I thought of Consider Fleabas at Vavatch. Shame, the movie, and Never Let Me Go, as I mentioned earlier, the novel for Never Let Me Go, superior, personally. Death and the Maiden, innumerable horror movies that focus on debasement, experience, suffering, pleasure, and so on. Far too many to mention, but very obviously, Hellraiser, like I said, things like Hostel. And although tame by comparison to all of these, I think there is something to be said simply within the motivations of Soren in Star Trek Generations. He's a lone survivor. He's determined to return to a realm of absolute pleasure and contentment, and to do so by any means necessary, even the destruction of planets, inflicting any number of casualties. Honestly, though, this is all just food for thought, because the list is endless, as would be any interpretations you could draw from them. If you have some good ideas, though, throw them down in the comments. But I think very obviously what I'm trying to get at is that although you have these base, quite extreme physical activities, the concept is more mental, it's more psychological, it's about exploring the mentality of the human condition and those kind of extremes. We don't really want to see Slaanesh descend into basically literary porn. But at the same time, if you're going to have an existence of a god of the human condition, a god of excess, of desire, prince of pleasure, she who thirsts, I think personally for me, it's pretty weak to create such a dark concept and then serve up consistent half measures. And it might not be to everybody's tastes, and some might label it as gratuitous, unnecessary, and so on, just as they do with horror films and some of the more extreme examples in that sense. But I feel like you can go about these things if you do approach it with an angle of a character or a background to a world that is set upon exploring and indulging in these experiences. And that's why I suggest very often about the Warhammer Crime series, because that is the perfect theater for that to occur in. But it also brings me to the next part, which is basically, how is it okay to have things like the Night Lords flaying people explicitly left, right, and center? How is it okay to have demon worlds with descriptions of humans being force-fed and then starved to create human skin farms? How is it okay to have the extreme descriptions of the effect of Nurgle on the human form? But for the god of experience, of human experience and sexuality, let's just stick to those noise marines. The uncomfortable problem with Slaanesh lies with some of the fundamental tenets for translating a verse to other formats. Firstly, sincerity, and also authenticity. Now, there's always room for interpretation and adaptation, so let's not be too extreme. Very often people question why a book is not translated specifically straight into a movie as it was in the book. And the answer for that is, you can't. Usually books are 10 times longer in terms of the actual material than your average movie. Plus, very often books describe and illustrate characters in a way which doesn't translate to the screen, because very often they have internal thoughts. That's why you have scriptwriters and to create a screenplay. So like I say, there's always room for interpretation, there's always room for adaptation. This is a thing which just has to happen. But things will have to remain fundamentally authentic to the source material, which very often is something we see not happening in the modern era, where we see people coming in basically wearing a badge of honor, saying, I don't know anything about this verse, I haven't read any of the material, but I do know what I want to say about it, which is just completely insane. In terms of Slaanesh, it raises significant problems, because from the visualization of raw human forms in nudity, sexual engagement, consensuality, any adjacent conflict that may or may not offend others, this is quite obviously going to be the kind of thing which is very highly charged, very controversial, very difficult to adapt. Yet, even if we were not considering things that many might see as explicit, Slaanesh still remains very problematic because, as I said earlier, just the dark, depressing nature of it tends to lead toward things like the submission of others, the enslavement, the torture, basically all of those things which are not going to appeal to MasterCard, Coca-Cola, or McDonald's for their branding campaigns of your movie. We are in a very strange period of time also when it comes to culture. We have the ability to create and share and engage with more than at any prior point in human history. You can take or leave whatever you want. At the same time though, we're also continually discussing the limits of such things. Now, quite honestly, I would love to spend the time to write a thesis, probably a book, if I really invested the time and effort into discussing ideas, concepts of morality and humanity, because they're infinitely interesting. In terms of in our own world, in our own lives, there are many, many factors that constrain, that dictate what we can and cannot do, exist, what we can engage with, and how these lines often shift and change specifically from generation to generation. The idea of something being permissible, something being bland and not particularly interesting in one generation and being absolutely outrageous in another. There's always that old adage of sex sells. And that may always have been somewhat true if you wanted to consider this in terms of the world's oldest profession and so forth. But the idea of selling products through glamour and the endless examples of poorly judged advertising from banned pot noodle and Kinder Bueno ads to all manner of other formats, we could really discuss reams of banned content from movies, video games, and so on. But I think to just speak very generally, often what was considered acceptable 20 or even just 10 years ago ages very, very quickly. And you can call it whatever you want to, or whether you think it's acceptable or not. But there is a whole range of content now which carries warnings, or that companies find so embarrassing, they just remove it from being accessible entirely. So broadly speaking, we're saying cultural norms shift. That's the point. This isn't anything new. It's why we don't cover up the table legs of furniture anymore, as we did in the Victorian age. And I'll just allow a few outraged people to leave comments about that. Before I note that this never was actually a thing, they didn't cover up table legs. That's a myth that's just stuck around for a long time. But there were certainly many periods in the past century where censoring and morality were heavily pushed on society. And as much as people like to think we're living in the apocalypse times for content cancelling, I think I would take the world today over the era of, say, the temperance movement emerging in the late 19th, early 20th century. Anyway, details, details. The point is that humans have a long history of enforcing views and restrictions upon others. This is only made more absurd by the fact that movies which were often banned decades previous ended up being released later, when we realise that actually, by modern standards, they are not really that bad, and it's reputation alone which is carrying them forward. Just a small offhand example, and this isn't particularly relevant in terms of outrage, but when The Exorcist first came out, The Exorcist was seen as this almost unwatchable film. It was so terrifying, so disturbing, so offensive. And then when they re-released it a little while ago, a lot of people thought it was kind of silly, tame, not that interesting. I actually think it's a fantastic film for a lot of different reasons, not the scary stuff so much, just in terms of conceptually, and especially Exorcist 3. This is, of course, without even diving into the whole nonsense related to classifications and ratings, things that are acceptable in one country and not another. It's this constantly shifting scale. A movie that was scary and disturbing 20 years ago, 30 years ago, is tame by modern comparison. All of this simply just denotes the fact that humans at one time or another will find certain details of our entertainment more or less acceptable. It's a sliding scale, and whether you agree or not, it appears unlikely to change that governments and adjacent official bodies dictate what is and isn't acceptable. That's the world we live in. However, there is of course this one distinct red line which seems to be the standard fare in humanity, which always seems bizarre. Explicit, extreme violence, 100% fine. Sex, 100% not fine for general public consumption. Which is really fascinating and stupid to me. Take any example you want to from movies, a person being destroyed physically, literally skinned alive, hours of torture in a movie. What about The Walking Dead, where Glenn smashed to a pulp? Actually, that's a bad example, because it was one of the most stupid executive decisions in entertainment history, because they basically killed their franchise overnight with a literal killing blow, to add to what were already many terrible decisions in how that series had been constructed and delivered. But jokes aside, most of the time, the point that I'm making is any level of violence is acceptable, although apparently not if it's a beloved character. Anyway, sex on the other hand, it's not straightforward to represent in media, unless it's very heavily concealed through editing, framing, or you're on a pay-per-view service like HBO, but even then the restrictions continue, hence the famous mocking of Game of Thrones by South Park. For it to be acceptable at all, the representation has to be absolutely clear that it is serious. It is not for gratification purposes. Hence, you must be either a very artistic or gritty movie or show, and it helps to add a script with a psychologically complex narrative. Of course, many people in recent decades have been noting that they're not offended by sex in media. It's more that it's just boring and uninteresting, which is likely due to the restrictions they have to have in order to have it in the first place, which I think likely aligns with the fact of something that I've said for the longest time, which is, you know, the internet exists, right? It's paired with the fact that seemingly more and more people are speaking out against it, and very often voicing that they want it to be entirely less accessible. It's a conversation we see ever more, and many would argue it's key to the safe development of our society into the future. And there are a lot of sensible, very good arguments as to why that is necessary. At just the more mainstream level of content, though, more people than ever just seem to simply want to do away with sexy scenes in movies. Because, like I said, it's kind of boring, it wastes time, everybody's like, yeah, let's get back to what's happening. Frankly, I am one of those people. If two characters are supposed to be romantically entangled, or I guess even not romantically, little is really gained by demonstrating this to us. Interestingly, I saw a few articles recently that declared sexy is back, and that Hollywood is forcibly reintroducing more sexy scenes in movies. Okay, fine, whatever. But it feels a bit weird and desperate to have to sort of declare this outright. Just put it in your films, put it in your shows, if you really feel it's necessary. Maybe consider, why are people coming to see your film? Is it for boring minutes of tedious, awkward, scripted, carefully filmed and moderated, not in any way explicit, fumbling in bed? Or, you know, are they coming for the story? All of this, though, is just foundational to the point that we're in this weird time where somehow spicy content is more accessible than ever, yet simultaneously more denounced than ever. What is even more interesting is the fact that if sex sells, it's a strange time when sponsors and advertisers descend into an absolute moral panic every time any platform attempts to normalize such content or fail to properly moderate it on their platform. Look at YouTube's apocalypse, the absolutely hilarious catastrophic fail that Twitch made recently when overnight they enabled what can only be described as a furry meltdown, and the immediate U-turn when it is believed by many that advertisers must have turned around to the heads of Twitch and said, have you completely lost your minds? It was very humiliating for Twitch, a platform that already has a track record of being extraordinarily out of touch with its own creators and users, and therefore extremely enjoyable to see. But I'm just going to say it, those bricky forehead streams were something I think we would all admit were a guilty, guilty pleasure. To just reel things back though, overall, the idea is something like Slaanesh is going to be always deeply problematic to translate outside of the existing verse it's in, if not deeply uncomfortable to represent in a more mainstream format. And that is really the key here overall, mainstream. In whatever content Games Workshop eventually ends up creating, and I don't care if the Cavill series is happening or not happening or whatever rumors somebody's decided to create this week, it's irrelevant, because at some point there will be a 40k series or a movie that carries a mainstream budget and is aimed at those audiences. Whether it happens now, whether it happens later, it will happen eventually. And you might say, well, hang on, there are loads of shows that feature pretty problematic scenes, especially in the horror genre or the more extreme side of things, or like I said, even stuff like Game of Thrones. Sure, except that most often those pieces of media, in terms of the extreme horror stuff, understand that out of the gate, they're generally not going to be advertised or target the awareness of a heavy percentage of the viewing audience, and their budget usually reflects that. In terms of shows that are either on Amazon or stuff like Game of Thrones, yes, they have problematic scenes, but they tend to be very narratively structured, specific, and even then they can still be kind of contentious and a little bit risky. Whenever 40k comes along, they're going to want to appeal to the masses. There's no doubt at all. It's never going to be designed purely for the existing 40k audience, which means dilution out of the gate. It also means minimizing things that are problematic ahead of time. And Slaanesh has always been a thorny, problematic issue. How do you talk about it without turning the story into straight up extreme pornography? Games Workshop sidestepped that problem by focusing on the Astartes, the Third Legion traitors, because they are a higher form. They don't concern themselves with those tedious base experiences. No, they're operating on an altogether a higher plane of existence. Ooh, I felt a chill breeze pass over my skin. How sensual. And so on and so on. Meanwhile, just out of sight, 300 slum hive workers are bonking themselves to death. Until it's addressed though, and even if it were ignored, Slaanesh remains a giant pink third Legion elephant in the room for any future family-friendly 40k mainstream adventures. Ultimately, I think Slaanesh is never going to get its true exploration, for all the reasons highlighted. Even if you kept away from more of the spicy stuff and focused just upon the exploitation of others to indulge in the twisted desires of the worshippers of Slaanesh, it's still pretty heavy going, and for many I think it will just be too bleak and harrowing. If you asked me to imagine how it will be likely represented in any kind of visual form, it would probably be something along the lines of in the 300 movie, Xerxes really disturbing Harim back at his camp, and there's all sorts of ladies and weird creatures and stuff happening there, and it's kind of blurry and a bit out of focus because they're trying to get you to feel it rather than look at the specifics. And then on top of that with Slaanesh, if you throw in potential issues of consensuality and all the stuff that comes with that, it's just a big problem they probably don't want to deal with. And whilst narratively it would be very interesting to explore, for anybody other than ultra lore nerds, it's probably just seen as a trouble coupled with a burden, which for me is a shame. Because I do think that when you have a verse and a theme of a realm which explores the very limits, the concepts of the human condition, existential explorations of what our reality is and how we exist, what are the absolute limits of human sensory experiences, as seen with, say, the Cenobites. It is, to me, a waste to not at least have a crack at a really dark novel that tries to explore these ideas. And yes, it would probably end up being decried and reviewed as edgy, if they're lucky, at worst, a catastrophic debacle that could be reputation-destroying and scandalous, leading to unwanted attention within other problematic aspects of the 40k verse. And now that I've said that out loud, maybe it's why they haven't written such material yet. But in seriousness, if you were to hand this particularly thorny puzzle over to a solid author, you genuinely could end up with a masterpiece of work that explores the darkest corners of the human soul, that elevates Slaanesh to a new level of horror and demonstrates why it deserves to be just as feared, if not more so, than any of the other gods. Not to mention the fact that by any reasonable estimation, Slaanesh should be more horrifying than, say, the Jokari or the Night Lord's activities, which should theoretically pale in comparison. It's just something we never really see described other than in the artwork, of course, which just seems a waste to me. Now, will we see the end of Slaanesh? It seems unlikely. Will we see the slow death of Slaanesh into obscurity, or at a position it can remain ways at arm's length? This seems quite probable. It's the most likely scenario to my mind, death by dilution. I've always had this feeling that when it comes to Slaanesh, they didn't really want to deal with it. They're holding back and avoiding the worst, or arguably the best of it, to ensure that when 40k expands to a vast mainstream audience, they're not suddenly deluged with how problematic Slaanesh is in the future. That is to say, narratively treading water. Now on the one hand, you might say, well hang on Lutin, there's quite a lot of stuff in 40k that's already quite problematic from a moral, explicit or political characterization perspective of things, and it's something that is inexplicably already contentious and causes people with a baffling regularity to be somehow unable to separate fiction from reality. But on the other hand, in terms of Slaanesh, I would ask you to remember that people's tolerance, like I said, of violence and in general representations of human suffering are surprisingly considerable, when one might argue that it is as equally morally disgusting. People can tolerate a lot of horrifying descriptions and narratives, as I was illustrating earlier, that are constructed around pretty extreme violence and suffering, just so long as there isn't somebody having spicy times just off to the side. It's completely insane, but it is the reality. Something something, Apocalypse Now, we train young men to drop fire on people, but their commanders won't allow them to write f*** on their airplanes because it's obscene. This is the insane and obscure reality that humans have decided upon, where extreme violence of almost any kind, 100% fine, partial nudity, mostly tolerable, within reason, spicy engagements of characters, careful now, actual explicit moments, no matter how relevant or momentary the screen time equals, advertisers literally spontaneously combusting and heads simultaneously exploding. So, will we see Slaanesh consigned to the background as that thing we don't speak to or go any deeper than superficial descriptions of, or characters that engage with higher levels of experience? It seems very likely, in my opinion, Slaanesh is going to be consigned to Space Marine battles. Phabius Bile experiments, occasional demon incursions, and Emperor's children fighting with each other over who has the best hair. In some respects, you can't blame GW for not wanting to roll the very spiky pink dice, because quite honestly, there are already many areas of 40k they must undoubtedly be worried about and aware are just going to be difficult for them when they try to break into that mainstream sphere. I'll save that discussion for the future. And yes, it is always easy for me to just sit here as some outside observer, saying that the way to go would be to just completely own it, say it proudly that this is the world we've created, it is dark, it is uncomfortable, and some parts of it you may or you may not enjoy. Of course, in doing that, it would require an astonishing level of naivety to actually believe that's how things would pan out in the world we live in. Because for 40k to be adapted to the mainstream, there will be a softening of edges in general, and certainly a distancing or convenient omission of material that's problematic. So apologies to the Chaos Cult worshippers and general sickos out there, aka Iron Warriors fans. I'm joking, please forgive. The bottom line is no on-screen demonculaba for you. And as I said at the start, certainly no Sorotas squad trapped on a Slaanesh demon planet remake of Dead Sky Black Sun. I would comfortably wager that will never see the light of day. For those who do, though, enjoy some deep thought about human experience and just what Slaanesh could look like as it sweeps through a hive city, corrupting, twisting it beyond recognition, with all manner of disturbing characters playing power games, attempting to one-up one another, gain the favour of Slaanesh through ever more perverse means, as they look down upon the streets below, awash with blood, fluid, and masses of flesh. One figure, a curator of the arts perhaps, inspects and observes his other living artworks that are a step above even the worst creations of the homunculi. Others have created vast pleasure pits, each catering to the very worst indulgences for humanity, and within the inner circles have disintegrated any remnants of moral or ethical structure, as it was within human civilization. And on and on. I would personally love to write something along these lines and really get into the sort of psychology, the mental aspects, the physical nightmare of it. But I think such explorations are only ever going to be visited within narrative creations outside of the 40k verse. If we were to consider how Slaanesh was to be destroyed though, how would that appear and who, if any, could achieve it? Enter Ivrain versus Slaanesh. For those unaware, Ivrain is a former gladiatrix of the Drakari and now the high priestess of the new founded religion of the Inari. They worship Ennead, the nascent Eldar god of the dead. Ivrain's ultimate objective is to save the Eldari race from the predations of Slaanesh by awakening Ennead, who they believe holds the potential to battle Slaanesh in a final confrontation, thereby destroying it and releasing the Eldar souls, not to mention restoring the Eldar to their former glory by gifting them once again, theoretically, immortality. Ivrain has continued to grow the faction of the Inari by demonstrating and recruiting more Eldari to embrace the path of the dead. Not a path of despair, but one of hope and renewal. Through her teachings, many Eldar now see death as not the end, but as a transformation, a return to Ennead. Currently, in the contemporary period of the galaxy, the Inari are waging a crusade of their own adjacent to that of the Imperium. Yet they have not fully yet awakened Ennead. They have only been so far able to release its avatar, the Incarnae. To fully unleash Ennead, Ivrain requires the Crone Swords. These are the legendary weapons in Eldari lore, imbued with immense power. They were forged by the master smith god Vol and linked to the ancient myths of Eldar culture. Each sword possesses unique abilities tied to the fate of their people, and for Ivrain and the Inari, these swords are significant, as they harness ancient energy, providing a significant source of strength and energy pivotal in her effort to awaken Ennead. So Ivrain crusades for the Inari and sets upon finding these Crone Swords that would see them arrive at some of the most dangerous and hidden corners of the galaxy. Each sword usually is guarded by formidable challenges, and only if she were able to overcome this mission would the Inari be able to perform the rituals to awaken Ennead and fulfill the ancient prophecies that guide the Inari's path, enabling the possibility of then destroying Slaanesh and ushering in a new era for her people. While the final confrontation with Slaanesh looms ever closer for the Inari, four of the five swords are already in their possession, yet the final sword has been placed within the palace of Slaanesh by a greater demon. This has left the Inari at a point they are unsure how to overcome, for the palace of Slaanesh is said to be a nightmare labyrinthine construct somewhere within the warp, the realm of chaos. And to reach this, you must traverse six circles of the realm of Slaanesh which surround it. The circle of avidity exploits greed, while the circle of gluttony tempts with lavish foods and wines. The circle of carnality tests one's deepest desires, and the circle of paramountcy lures with promises of absolute power. In the penultimate circle of vainglory, the traveller is confronted with their ideal self-image, and any pride results in eternal imprisonment. The final circle, a heavenly place, fills the intruder with bliss, but resting for a moment leads to a coma and eventual death in idle pleasure. So it's not something that one would seek to enter recklessly. Finally, should one succeed, then they still must face Slaanesh, whose sight enslaves mortals, consuming their souls and making them willing servants. Understandably, this presents something of a problem for Ivrain and the Inari. Some might consider an impossible task. Yet they have not abandoned hope of this paradoxical problem of having to seemingly defeat Slaanesh in order to defeat Slaanesh. For as it was said, Ivrain knew in her heart that the vision was true and that the path of blades was now closed to her. There was but one way, now to defeat she who thirsts. Ivrain had sought this path as the less destructive way to destroy Slaanesh. Now, there remained only one method possible. Since the fall, a crystal tome has rested upon a plinth of the heart of the Eldar Black Library. Shortly before the opening of the Great Rift, the tome fell open, and within were revealed writings said to have come from the god of the Eldar Harlequins. They reveal a final act that has, for those aware of it, changed the tale of the Eldar Fall. The Eldar Strands of Fate had always warned that Chaos would be victorious during the final battle at the galaxy's end. Many have their own word for such a battle. For the Eldar, this is known as the Rana Dandra. This final act promised a new path, and that the Eldar Harlequin's god, Kegarak, believed to still exist somewhere within the Webway, would play its ultimate jest and trick Slaanesh into expending all her energies not to destroy the Eldari, but to save them. How such a thing could come to pass remains unclear, but the Harlequins are devoted servants, and they will see the final act performed no matter the cost. It may well be that the Inari have a part within this to play, and the ultimate resolution could see the rise of the Inari and the unleashing of the Eldar God of the Dead to finally vanquish and destroy Slaanesh.